Well, hello everyone. It is time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, May 15th, 2024. A reminder that all material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHack. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for some sun and then turning cloudy today with the winds from the southeast at 6 to 12 miles per hour. Thunderstorm is possible tonight, however, there are some showers in spots also to the east. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 74 degrees with a low of 60. Sun turning cloudy later today with thunderstorms this evening. Across the area, sunny, and then some stuff moving in tonight. On a national basis, as for temperatures, on Tuesday it was 100 degrees in Zapata, Texas, and 21 in Fairplay, Colorado. Turning over now to the headlines in today's Des Moines Register, on our front page is ACLU says jail fees used for laser tag, and GPS goes kerflooey. And here to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb.
The ACLU says jail fees were used for laser tag. Blackhawk County collects hundreds of thousands of dollars per year from jail inmates to pay for their room and board. But in a new lawsuit, the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa says that's not where the money is going. In fact, according to the complaint filed Monday, the sheriff's office has used money from inmates' jail fees on a variety of perks, including a wellness app and a gun range outfitted with laser tag equipment and cotton candy and ice cream machines that is usable only by its employees and their families. And, according to the ACLU, the sheriff is bypassing the process laid out by the statute to collect those fees, instead having prisoners sign paperwork waiving their rights to contest the amount of their reimbursement or payment plan for it. As a result, they say, Blackhawk County brings in more than double what peer counties receive from jail fees, of which the sheriff's office takes 40% to spend as it sees fit. On one occasion, when county leaders sought to exercise greater oversight over the funds, the ACLU says Sheriff Tony Thompson simply stopped collecting the fees until the county backed down. By evading judicial review and refusing to collect jail fees, when control of the fund was wrested from it, the department has made its aim clear, use any means necessary to avoid scrutiny of a program that is used to enrich the department and its employees, the complaint says. Attorneys for the ACLU and the director and the debtors' prison project at Public Justice, who are working together on the case, said during a conference call with reporters Monday that if counties choose to assess jail fees as permitted by state law, the fees should be spent on jail services they are substantively meant to pay for. The fact that the money is not even actually being used to pay for room or board or other jail costs that it's being assessed for only makes this more outrageous, ACLU legal director Reader Bettis Austin said. It's profoundly unfair and wrong. The lawsuit is drafted as a class action on behalf of potentially thousands of former detainees who have signed paperwork assenting to jail fees. The county has not yet responded in court. Thompson defended his office's collection efforts and use of the resulting funds in a statement Monday, which said it would seem disingenuous to have these very programs be paid for by the hardworking taxpayers when they are the ones who are already victimized by the offender. Under state law, sheriff's offices can bill detainees who have been convicted or sentenced for their room and board and any medical care received. Attorney Charles Moore of Public Justice estimated Monday that about two-thirds of the Iowa counties do so, although their charge rates and collection practices vary wildly. Blackhawk County charges fees of $70 per day plus a $25 booking fee. According to the complaint, from July 2021 to July 2023, the county brought in nearly $600,000. Scott County brought in about a quarter of that amount over the same 2 years, and Dallas County less than half. All three counties have populations between 100,000 and 175,000, with Blackhawk County in the middle with about 130,000. Polk and Johnson counties do not bill inmates for room and board, although Polk County does for some medical expenses, according to the complaint. Linn County also has discontinued assessing jail fees, it said. Although ostensibly charging for room and board, counties are not required to apply the fees they collect toward jail operations. Under state law, they must spend 60% on law enforcement uses, such as courthouse security or jail infrastructure costs. The law is silent as to the other 40%. In Blackhawk County, according to the complaint, the sheriff's office maintains full control over the remainder, which is placed in a 40% fund. Under Thompson, the office has used that money to build and outfit its gun range facility in Raymond, including, allegedly, with laser tag equipment, among other accoutrements. In 2019, according to the lawsuit, Blackhawk County supervisors raised concerns about some of the expenses paid for out of the 40% fund, and in 2022 passed a resolution to direct the money to the county general fund instead. In response, the complaint says, Thompson directed his office to stop collecting jail fees entirely, relenting only after supervisors agreed several months later to return control of the undesignated 40% to the sheriff's office. The lawsuit alleges this shows an unlawful conflict of interest by the sheriff's office, as a sheriff is able to set fee rates, decide how to pursue the costs, and then spend a large share of the resulting proceeds on superfluous expenses for the sheriff's office and its employees. The lawsuit also accuses the sheriff of pursuing unlawful means to collect those debts. The suit alleges that detainees, including lead plaintiff Letitia Roberts, are given paperwork when they are discharged that includes a so-called confession of judgment, agreeing to pay their fees and authorizing the county to seek court-ordered garnishment if they do not. Roberts, who was billed for more than $700 after two arrests for drunken driving in 2022, says she was told she needed to sign the documents to have her belongings returned. Although the form Roberts signed doesn't explain it, a confession of judgment is a legal filing waiving all rights to contest a debt collection action in court, including claims that the amount is incorrect or that the signer is unable to pay. It also includes giving up the right to be notified when the creditor files a confession with the court, where a clerk approves the order without any judicial review. Confessions of judgment are a controversial legal tool that are outlawed or restricted in many states. Several recent lawsuits from student loan borrowers allege that Iowa's pre-Civil War statute lacks critical due process safeguards and is unconstitutional as applied to consumers. Monday's lawsuit alleges Blackhawk County is using confessions of judgment instead of the collection process laid out in the jail fee statute to avoid any judicial oversight over debts that may be unenforceable. It's being used in our circumstance for folks who are in jail. Literally, it's the last thing they do before they walk out of the jail's doors, before they get their freedom back, Moore said. It's a hugely problematic practice, and I think that our lawsuit just really underscores how abusive these practices can be. Thompson, in an emailed statement, confirmed his office charges detainees $70 per day for room, board, and utilities. Inmates have the option of signing a confession of judgment upon release from jail, he said, but they are not required to do so or to enter into payment plans. While the ACLU alleges the sheriff's Raymond Rage shooting facility is solely for the use of law enforcement and their families, Thompson told the Des Moines Register his office also hosts community days there for the public. In his statement, he defended spending jail fees, quote, promoting days where officers can spend time with their families and the community, dispelling myths about the office, ensuring better education of the public, and better informing their families of how to maintain their own safety, end quote. Those events, Thompson said, create dialogue and strengthen relationships between law enforcement and the general public. It seems ironic that the ACLU would call this practice into question when these are the very actions in the law enforcement model that they have been demanding since George Floyd, Michael Brown, Breonna Taylor, and beyond, Thompson said. Monday's lawsuit does not challenge the jail field statute entirely, Morse said in the conference call, but only those counties, like Black Hawk, that are circumventing the legal collection process through confessions of judgment. The sheriff is able to sort of operate in the shadows without subjecting this scheme to any review by the courts, he said. But while the statute as written is not the target of this case, ACLU officials said they have deep concerns about any county that adopts a pay-to-stay model for its jails. These debts are significant collateral consequences for people that can hold them back in their ability to succeed after serving a sentence, Austin said.
Our next article from the front page, GPS goes kerflooey. After days of rain, Jolene Rison's family was able to finish planting the last acres of corn on their northwest Iowa farm this weekend, but it wasn't easy. The solar storm that caused the northern lights to erupt in the nighttime skies over Iowa, shimmering in waves of red, green, purple, pinks, and blues, played havoc with the Rison's tractor as they planted Saturday and Sunday. Across the country, it disrupted satellite connections to global positioning systems that guide the tractors during planting. The Rison's lost their GPS signal a half dozen times over the weekend. Modern technology is great when it works, said Rison, who farms and raises cattle with her sons Lee and Corey in Ida and Sac counties. They were lucky to even be out in their fields. Iowa has quickly shifted from a four-year drought to frequent rainstorms, idling many farmers hoping to complete planting, said Doug Hauser, an Iowa State University Extension digital agriculture specialist. So far, Iowa farmers have planted 57% of the state's corn crop and 39% of the soybeans, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reported Monday, putting them on a pace 1 week behind last year's, according to the report. Rison said that her farm, her son, Lee, kept planting going by using a marker that farmers relied on before GPS guided their tractors, a disc on the marker, a folding arm that extends from the planter. Rows along with the planter, marking a line that provides guidance when the farmer turns to plant the next row. Farmers center their tractors on the line in the soil to keep the needed distance between rows. That's the old-fashioned way, Rison said. Friends in Nebraska had removed the marker arms from their planter, so they were stranded until they were able to reconnect to satellites. GPS does more than just guide farmers on when and where to turn. The system also tells the planter when to stop sending seed into the soil and guides farmers when they're spraying chemicals that kill weeds or insects. The increased planting and spraying efficiency saves farmers money, especially important in a year with declining crop prices. Farmers occasionally lose satellite connections, but nothing like Sunday, Rison said. Hauser also said the frequency of satellite interruptions over the weekend was unusual. Something like this is very rare, he said. With the solar storm subsiding, Rison said her family hopes to switch over to planting soybeans Tuesday. But another kind of storm continues to challenge farmers, with chances of rain in the forecast across Iowa two or four more days this week. Widespread wet conditions last week have delayed planting progress, and it's certainly weighing on the minds of farmers, Mike Nagg, Iowa's agriculture secretary, said in a statement about the planting report, adding, planters continue to be parked across much of the state. And on another article here, Iowa nurses' Medicare fraud case settled for $52,000. In exchange for less than $53,000, federal officials have agreed to settle civil claims against a Des Moines nurse accused of participating in a million-dollar scheme to defraud Medicare. Ashley Brown, an advanced registered nurse practitioner, has paid $52,560 to the United States to resolve civil allegations that she violated federal law by signing hundreds of medically unnecessary prescriptions for expensive orthotic braces in exchange for kickbacks. Timothy T. Dawks, U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa, said in a written statement that the settlement reflects his office's intent to aggressively pursue medical providers who seek to profit by outsourcing their medical decision-making. The federal government had alleged that from April 17th of 2020 to May 19th of 2021, Brown knowingly submitted more than $1 million in false claims for payment to taxpayer-funded Medicare while working for a company called Barton Associates. The Department of Justice alleged Brown did so by writing hundreds of prescriptions for orthotic braces that were not medically necessary. Several patients subsequently told investigators that they did not know Brown, did not need the braces, and did not request the braces. Brown had even prescribed a brace for an Elkhart man whose left leg had been amputated years earlier, the department said. Brown reportedly spent as little as 9 seconds reviewing the records of patients for Barton Associates before approving them for braces, and in some cases had never had any contact with the patients. In return for each of her prescriptions, Brown allegedly collected what the government characterizes as, quote, a kickback of $20 per patient from Barton Associates, sometimes resulting in hundreds of dollars in income for a few minutes' work. Barton Associates was not a party to the lawsuit, and federal court records indicate there are no pending civil or criminal charges against the company. No one in the office of the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa was available to make questions or take questions on the matter Monday morning. In 2022, a Kentucky doctor agreed to pay $561,800 to resolve allegations that while partnering with Barton, he violated the False Claims Act by submitting false claims to Medicare for unnecessary equipment. Brown's license is in good standing with the Iowa Board of Nursing, and she has no record of any disciplinary action against her license.
A judge criticizes the state's case for firing a veterans home employee. In a ruling that takes the state to task for its investigation of alleged sexual harassment at the Iowa Veterans Home, a judge has awarded unemployment benefits to a former supervisor fired in response to vague allegations of misconduct. According to state records, Brett Schutt worked for the state-run Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown as a full-time service supervisor until he was fired in February 2024. Schutt has previously worked at the home as an assistant food service director. While working in food service, Schutt supervised a female employee who also had supervisory responsibilities. According to the findings of the administrative law judge, Sean Nelson, who presided over a recent hearing on Schutt's request for unemployment benefits, Schutt and the woman were, at least initially, on friendly terms, engaging in various conversations with each other and fishing together at a pond with their respective families. Sometime in 2022, while Schutt was supervising the woman, the two allegedly met in her office, where she told him, "I would cheat on my husband with you." A few days later, the woman approached Schutt in his office. Quote, "The woman did not have a bra on and caressed her breasts through her shirt to seduce him," Nelson stated in his findings. Schutt did not respond to the woman's actions, and nothing similar occurred in the days that followed. However, the woman continued to confide in Schutt about her frustrations with her marriage and her, quote, "use of various illegal drugs," Nelson said. Schutt then moved into the position of public service supervisor at the Iowa Veterans Home, after which he and the woman clashed over her treatment of employees in three separate personnel cases. In all three cases, Schutt was concerned the woman had dismissed valid concerns raised by the workers. In September 2023, the woman separated from her husband and moved to a house close to the Iowa Veterans Home. In the weeks that followed, she and Schutt clashed again over the treatment of Iowa Veterans Home staff, and Schutt allegedly confronted her about her use of illegal drugs, asking if drug use had played a role in her behavior. He noted that the frequency of her drug use was picking up, and he was concerned, Nelson stated in his findings. Days later, the woman filed a sexual harassment complaint against Schutt, who was then placed on paid administrative leave, pending the completion of an investigation. According to Nelson's findings, the woman alleged Schutt had, on several occasions, followed her in his car while she was driving home, had once entered her home, and had once asked to meet her at a local park. The woman also claimed Schutt threatened to show photographs of some kind to her husband. The complaint she filed, quote, "did not ever specify what these pictures were of, but the employer assumed they were pictures of her, perhaps compromising ones," Nelson stated in his findings. When the Iowa Department of Administrative Services investigated the matter, Schutt was interviewed. He denied all of the allegations, but DAS subsequently recommended Schutt be fired for violating sexual harassment policies. On February 28, 2024, the state conducted a hearing on Shutt's possible termination, in which Shutt recounted the instances in which he felt the woman had sexually harassed him. He also raised the fact that there had been other employees who had engaged in confirmed incidents of sexual harassment and had been given five-day suspensions. Shutt also alleged he had heard from two subordinates that the state's Bureau Chief of Human Resources, Melissa Sangnecht, had been involved in spreading a rumor about a woman sleeping with the commandant of the Ara Veterans Home. The day after the hearing, the state fired Shutt. Quote, he was never interviewed regarding allegations he made against Ms. Sangnecht, Nelson stated in his finding. No investigation was conducted. Shutt was awarded unemployment benefits shortly after he was fired, but the state appealed that decision, which led to the matter going before Nelson for a hearing on the issue. During that hearing, state officials said the example Shutt cited of workers being suspended for a few days due to sexual harassment were not comparable to the case at hand because they involved lower-level workers, not supervisors. They argued that a leadership employee of the state had previously been fired for egregious sexual harassment, but then declined to provide Nelson with specifics, citing confidentiality. In his ruling, Nelson concluded the state had not met its burden of proving misconduct by Shutt, and that even if it had, it could not show that it applied the underlying rules on sexual harassment in an even-handed and uniform manner. Shutt, the judge ruled, provided a plausible explanation to support his allegations that the woman filed a false report of sexual harassment against him. He provided credible testimony that even if the behavior had occurred, it may have been welcomed. Nelson also faulted the Iowa Veterans Home for relying on an investigative report made by a third party, DAS, noting the state didn't bother to provide the report as part of its appeal, and instead read excerpts from it during the hearing. As for the report itself, Nelson said it appeared from the testimony that it lacked any detail as to the intent or even the basic circumstances of events that were used to make the case for Shutt's firing. For instance, the woman alleges Shutt walked into her house on September 27, 2023, Nelson noted. No explanation is given in terms of how she got in. It is unclear whether he broke into the house and even if there were any interaction between the two people. In addition, Nelson said, the state accused Shutt of showing or threatening to show photos to the woman's husband, but Sangnecht confirmed during an unemployment hearing that the investigation never even determined what those pictures were, let alone whether they were sexual in nature. Nelson affirmed the initial decision awarding Shutt unemployment benefits.
In more Metro and Iowa news, DNR wants AG to seek penalties and spill. 750,000 fish killed along the Nishnabotna system. State environmental regulators want the Iowa Attorney General to take action against the agricultural cooperative behind the catastrophic nitrogen fertilizer spill that wiped out about 750,000 fish for 50 miles along the Nishnabotna River system in March. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources on Monday recommended Attorney General's office take over enforcement against New Cooperative, a Fort Dodge farmer-owned business that reported the spill at its Red Oak elevator on March 11th. The transfer of responsibility is allowed when a violation is particularly grave and exceeds the DNR's $10,000 cap on fines, officials said. Typically, with a spill that reaches Iowa waterways, DNR seeks an administrative penalty and restitution for the fish that were killed. The Iowa Environmental Protection Commission will consider referring enforcement against New Cooperative to the Attorney General's office at its May 22nd meeting in Ottumwa. Here's what we know about what led up to the Iowa DNR referral. How did the spill happen? Well, workers at New Cooperative's Red Oak elevator called the DNR field office near Atlantic at 5:30 a.m. on March 11th and reported that a valve on a line linked to a 500,000-gallon nitrogen tank had been left open all weekend. It released about 265,000 gallons of the liquid fertilizer into a stormwater drainage ditch that ran through a levee that emptied through an open floodgate into the East Nishnabotna River. The spill made its way to the Nishnabotna River, killing thousands of fish along the way. Iowa and Missouri fishery officials reported, before reaching the Missouri River and being diluted by the river's greater flow. So what did the new cooperative do in response? The cooperative built berms to contain the spill, pumped fertilizer from the ditch and the levee, used lime to soak up the fertilizer, and excavated contaminated soil. Closing the floodgate, new cooperative hired a consultant to sample recovered fertilizer to help determine the proper agronomic rates that it could be applied to cropland. Complicating the cooperative's efforts, the area on March 25 received up to 1.5 inches of rain, and Red Oak Police Chief Justin Rami ordered that the levee's floodgate open. That destroyed a berm where the flow from the stormwater ditch met the East Nishnabotna River. Iowa DNR ordered the floodgate closed again until the cleanup had been finished. By March 29th, new cooperative said the berm at the ditch and the river had been rebuilt. So is the cleanup completed? With storms expected in late April, new cooperative agreed to continue pumping the water around the stormwater ditch to avoid further contaminating the river. The co-op also has agreed to clean up contaminated soil in the ditch. The recovered water has or was being held on on-site tanks. What did the DNR do? The DNR environmental specialist Brent Martins worked with new cooperative to contain the spill and sampled water for nearly 34 miles along the Nishnabotna River. Martins and other Iowa DNR officials worked with their Missouri counterparts to assess the extent of the fish kill. Testing showed high levels of ammonia and nitrates. Is there any other action expected? Well, a group of Iowans have asked Iowa DNR Director Kayla Lyon to launch her own investigation to determine whether the state's policies need to be changed to prevent another massive spill. The letter, written by Drake University Law Professor Emeritus Neil Hamilton, former director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center, asked Lyon to, quote, pursue all available remedies, including civil and criminal action through the Attorney General's office. The letter, signed by former gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubble and former Iowa Lieutenant Governor Sally Peterson, among others, also asked Lyon to work with the Iowa Department of Agriculture to examine policies around storage of agricultural fertilizer and determine whether Iowa has, quote, gaps or inadequacies in the rules of their enforcement. Well, what do environmental groups say? We're glad to see the DNR is recommending further enforcement action through the Attorney General, Alicia Vasto, the Iowa Environmental Council's Water Program Director. This is an important first step in seeking justice for the river, the wildlife, and the communities impacted by this devastating incident. Ultimately, the final enforcement must reflect the grave impact the fertilizer spill has had on the East Nishnabotna, and further, we must demand more protective laws and rules that will prevent this type of event from happening again. And finally, what does New Cooperative say? The co-op, with 80 locations around Iowa, said earlier this month that it's worked with state regulators and others on the cleanup. Quote, we are deeply disappointed in what has happened, as New Cooperative has a strong environmental record, and is also the first time in the company's 50-year history that our emergency environmental response procedures have needed to be activated, the company said in an email. New Cooperative was founded by local farmers with roots in these communities, which furthers our resolve to work to clean up and mitigate this issue. It didn't comment on Iowa DNR's referral to the Iowa Attorney General's office on Monday.
Drake University receives a historic donation. Drake University has received the largest single donor donation in the Institute's history as part of the college's major The Ones campaign. Greg Johansson, a prominent Central Iowa resident, leader, and alumni of the Drake Pharmacy Program, donated $28 million to revitalize former dorm Morehouse Hall at 2803 University Avenue, which will become a student center with dedicated intercultural space. It will be called the Johansson Student Center after the historic donation. We are truly honored and thankful for Johansson's visionary support and commitment to advancing our mission, Drake University President Marty Martin said in a statement. Greg's generous commitment is an expression of his unwavering confidence in the power of the Drake experience and will play a pivotal role in driving progress and transformation across our institution. Johansson has a long history with Drake, first as a 1976 graduate of the Drake University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He has received the Lawrence C. and Dolores M. Weaver Medal of Honor and Distinguished Alumni Award. He serves on the college's board of trustees and is a senior advisor for GRX Holdings, LLC, which owns and operates several Medicare pharmacy locations. Quote, I believe in the mission of the college and that the students and graduates will do great things in the future, Johansson said in a news conference Tuesday announcing the donation. This gift commitment is a statement of gratitude to Drake University for the education I received here beginning more than 50 years ago, he said. The opportunity I was given to receive a Drake education was a gift to me, and now I am here to return the favor. The Johansson Student Center will be a student hub that will offer the campus first dedicated space for students from diverse populations, both domestic and international, that is welcoming and supportive of them, Martin previously said. In February 2023, Salmons Financial Group committed $3.15 million to create the Salmons Intercultural Center and an outdoor area called the Salmons Plaza at the Student Center. Construction is expected to wrap up in January, according to a news release. It will provide an incredible foundation of support, Drake Student Body President Ashley Dyson said. It will give the opportunity to find a sense of belonging, to evolve in an organization and causes. The Johansson donation also will go toward the College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, John D. Bright College, Drake Athletics, with an emphasis on women's basketball, sustainability efforts, including the installation of solar panels on the recently restored Meredith Hall, and the Drake Fund. The Ones, Drake's Campaign for the Brave and Bold campaign, launched in 2021 with a goal to raise $225 million that, among other goals, would expand its rural outreach, prepare more women and people of color for tech jobs, and build a new university center and performing arts venue. We said that our ambitious goal was a three-year sprint to $205 million, Drake Vice President John Smith said. Well, since our last campaign announcement, through the support of many others, we are very excited to announce that the total is now $247 million.
Blue Zoo Aquarium sets opening for next week. Hold on to your fins, the wait is almost over. You'll soon be able to see stingrays, starfish, and sharks right here in the heart of Iowa. After announcing plans to open last fall, Blue Zoo, a for-profit interactive aquarium geared toward children, will open to the public on May 21st. It is located in the Villages at Jordan Creek Town Center at 6925 Mill Civic Parkway in West Des Moines. People get sparked up at a young age about eco-consciously connecting with animals and their environment, said Steve Spiteri, one of the owners of Blue Zoo. We never get to see sea animals and interact with them, so I hope this sparks some of that. The nearly 20,000 square foot aquarium provides or includes all types of sea life, saltwater, or fresh tanks and tide pools. It has a bird forest with hundreds of parakeets, a reptile habitat with tortoises, lizards, and frogs, and a undersea sanctuary that acts as a sensory room. Guests can feed and pet stingrays and bamboo sharks in a shallow pool near a wet play area with a private ship and a bounce house. The aquarium also will host occasional mermaid and pirate shows. It's going to be a fantastic time, Mermaid Nixie said to a group of children on Saturday at a VIP event. The aquarium offers a concession stand, a photo booth, and interactive games for Iowa fish enthusiasts. This is a dream job for sure, said Lydia Venter, an employee at Blue Zoo. If they didn't bring this to Des Moines, I think I would have. Unlimited annual passes to Blue Zoo are available from $95 to $300. Day passes are $16 to $20. Tickets and passes can be purchased on the Blue Zoo website, which is desmoines.bluezoo.us, or in person. Until May 20th, unlimited annual passes can be purchased for 20% off with a code. The aquarium is open to those who purchase annual passes before the official open date. So what is the Blue Zoo? The Blue Zoo is a small for-profit aquarium chain that opened its first location in Spokane, Washington in 2019. Founder Wes Hawes said he got the idea for Blue Zoo as he whiled away the days watching a fish tank while recovering from an axe attack he suffered during an African house building project in 2010, according to the Blue Zoo website. It says the goal of the company is to educate people and teach children about the importance of marine conservation. Learning about different species of fish and creating coral reefs occupied both his time and his mind during the long weeks of rehabilitation, the Blue Zoo website says of Hawes. Today, Wes strives to pass his appreciation for aquatic life on to others. There are other Blue Zoo locations. In addition to Spokane, there are Blue Zoo locations in Oklahoma City, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Rogers, Arkansas. The company also is planning a location in Boise, Idaho. On its website, Blue Zoo has indicated it would like to build locations in Indiana, Montana, and Nevada as well.
Which Red Lobsters have closed in Iowa? At least two Red Lobster restaurants in Iowa are closed, joining dozens of other closures across the country. The seafood chain's website shows 87 locations are temporarily closed across America, USA Today reported. These closures come as Tag GX Brands, which helps restaurants remove and sell equipment after a closure, announced it was auctioning off restaurant equipment for more than 50 Red Lobster locations across America. As a liquidator called the sales the largest restaurant equipment auction ever. The seafood restaurant chain, which began in Florida in 1968 and was popular for its endless shrimp promotions and Cheddar Bay biscuits, was considering filing bankruptcy to restructure their debt, Bloomberg reported in April. Here's what we know. Is Red Lobster closing in Iowa? Two locations in Iowa are listed as temporarily closed on the restaurant chain's website and are also listed on Tag GX's auction. The Red Lobster in Waterloo at 941 East San Marnin Drive and the Red Lobster in Council Bluffs at 3040 Dial Drive. Managers of the Waterloo Red Lobster confirmed to TV station KWWL that the location closed abruptly and that they were let go from the chain per an article published Monday. How many Red Lobster locations are in Iowa? There are 8 Red Lobsters in the state, according to the restaurant's online store directory, including the closed Waterloo and Council Bluffs locations. Red Lobster's 6 remaining locations are in Ames, Cedar Rapids, Coralville, Davenport, Sioux City, and West Des Moines. Bloomberg reported in April that the restaurant chain was considering filing Chapter 11 bankruptcy and that it was challenged by current leases and labor costs. By filing for bankruptcy, Red Lobster would remain open as it reorganizes funds to pay off existing debt over time, seeking continue with better financial footing. Any discussions about restructuring are ongoing, and no financial decisions have been made about a bankruptcy filing as of April 18th. In 2023, Red Lobster also reported an $11 million loss in the third quarter following their endless shrimp deal, according to USA Today. And a series of closures is set for the Bill Riley Trail. Improvements are coming to Bill Riley Trail at Waterworks Park this summer and fall. Construction will force closures of the trail through the fall. Rehabilitation work is expected to happen in 4 phases. The Bill Riley Trail and a portion of the Walnut Creek Trail connector will be closed for improvements this summer through fall, the Des Moines Parks and Recreation Department posted on Facebook. The Post said there is no official timeline yet, but work isn't expected to begin for another several weeks. The department pledged to provide at least 2 weeks' advance notice. Contractors are expected to work until October. The city will require each phase to be completed before moving on to the next, in order to keep as much of the trail open as possible. The 4 phases, which may not be completed in this order, are the Walnut Creek Trail, North Valley Drive to Bill Riley Trail, the Bill Riley Trail from Ashworth Parking Lot to Walnut Creek Trail T Intersection, the Bill Riley Trail Walnut Creek Trail T Intersection to Waterworks Park Bridge, and the Bill Riley Trail Waterworks Park Bridge to Meredith Trail at Grays Lake. The trail will be receiving new overlay and paving this fall to summer. There will be other miscellaneous work involved, including pavement markings, traffic control, and landscaping, according to documents from the Des Moines City Council's May 6th meeting. The council approved awarding a contract for $887,887.50 to TK Concrete. The project also includes the replacement of the Ashworth Pole parking lot at the end of the season. To prepare for closures and stay up to date on Des Moines trails, you can check the city's website, visit Des Moines Park and Recreation on Facebook, or text DSM Trails to 84483.
We're now going to meet the candidates for West Des Moines House District 28. Republican State Representative David Young is facing a challenge from Republican Chad Brubaker and Democrat Laura Snyder in his bid for a second term in the Iowa House of Representatives. The three candidates are running in Iowa House District 28, which includes part of West Des Moines, Van Meter, and Adel. To help voters, the Des Moines Register sent questions to all federal and Des Moines area legislative candidates running for political office this year. Their answers have been lightly edited for length and clarity. The primary election is scheduled for June 4th ahead of the November 5th general election. So, David Young is the incumbent, who is age 56, a Republican. He grew up in Van Meter in Johnston. He lives currently in Van Meter. He went to Drake University and is a 1991 graduate with a Bachelor of Arts in English. He is the adjunct professor at Drake University and Iowa State Representative. His political experience and civic activities include U.S. Representative at the Iowa's 3rd District from 2015 to 2019 and the Iowa State Representative from 2023 through 2025. Chad Brubaker, who's 44, also a Republican, and grew up in Indianola, and currently lives in West Des Moines. He has a Bachelor of Science in Math and Computer Science from Drake University, and a Master of Science in Computer Science from Iowa State University, and currently is a software engineer. He's been involved, his grandson of Senator Earl Bass of Mills County, who served with Governor Ray, Ron Paul, state GOP delegate, Central Iowa Linux Users Group member, and a free software volunteer. And finally, Laura Snyder, 38, a Democrat, who grew up in Topeka, Kansas, and currently resides in West Des Moines. She has a Juris Doctorate in 2009, graduate of Drake University School of Law. Currently, she is an attorney/writer. Her political experience and civil activities include saying, "I have never been involved in politics. I have served on animal shelter boards and Habitat for Humanity boards." So we asked the question, what would be your top issue should you be elected? Young replied, "I will continue to fight for Iowans to keep more of their hard-earned paychecks by ensuring taxes stay low, increase access to quality and affordable physical and mental health care, and keep an Iowa a safe place to live and raise a family." Brubaker's response to the same question says he will restore honest government, no municipal tax bribes by Apple, Google to abscond from school property taxes. Iowa Citizens Aids will issue reports on well-path inmate pharmacy fraud and abuse at Polk County Jail from 2016 to 2022, and ongoing FDIC debit card scams with inmate commissary funds in the Dallas Polk counties. The Judicial Qualifications Commission secretary will be appointed by the House, not the Chief Justice. Investigate Polk County Attorney Kimberly Graham and Soros Signify Home Health questionable Medicaid payments for healthy young patients. Split Carlisle Group Sedgwick IACP into separate pools for municipal and county governments. Segregation of police and prosecutor pools to remove incentives to miss prison felonies. Snyder answered to the question of what would be your top issue, says bodily autonomy. So what policies would you support to improve Iowa's education system? Young said he would increase the starting teacher salary to the fifth highest in the nation and raise pay for paraprofessionals, and is a big important win this past session. We also set a minimum salary for 12-year teachers to $62,500. We must continue our work on teacher pay by allocating additional dollars to help with compaction issues, as well as raising pay for additional veteran teachers doing great work for our students. Brubaker responded by saying he would restore local control. You should be able to go to your school board with issues, not an unaccountable state board of education. and end municipal property tax bribes so schools are fully funded. Snyder's response to what policies would you support? She says teacher pay increases, defunding the voucher program, funding area education agencies, and funding public schools. What do you think of Iowa's tax policy, and what should it be? Do you believe the state's priority should be on lowering rates or spending on services for Iowans? Well, Young's response to that question says, I supported a fair and flat income tax of 3.8% for Iowans while ensuring retirement income is not taxed in Iowa. We've developed responsible budgeting principles that allow us to balance our budgets, keep taxes low, and invest record amounts of funding for education, mental health, public safety, rural broadband, and other important priorities for Iowans. By being responsible with the state budget and promoting economic growth, we can continue to keep taxes low and fund the services Iowans need. Brubaker's response, no property tax bribes for Apple and Microsoft. Flat income tax of 0% on the first $50,000 of income and flat tax rate above that. Snyder's response, Iowa's tax policy should be proportionate to the income of the taxpayer. Corporations should pay their fair share. People are facing rising costs in housing, groceries, and costs in daily necessities. Wages aren't rising to meet those rising costs. The Register asked, what policies would you support to improve school safety in Iowa? Young's response, the past session we passed legislation to lower emergency response times and invest in school safety infrastructure. I led the effort to empower a task force to determine what the gold standard for a school safety building code should be. I would then prioritize investing additional funding to ensure schools reach that gold standard in helping to keep our children and school personnel safe. It's also important we continue to address children's mental health by ensuring access to care and empowering parents with responsible social media laws to protect our children. Brubaker's response, to what policies would you support to improve school safety? Brubaker says, 5-gallon bucket of claw hammers to every classroom for service projects. Airsoft in junior high physical education and rifle in high school PE so kids fear and respect firearms again. Snyder's response, readily available mental health and substance abuse treatment for students and their parents. Social media safety courses for students and parents. Student-led school safety boards and parent-led school safety boards. Firearm safety regulations like safe storage statutes and the reinstatement of the previous permit requirements to carry firearms. And finally, the last question. What next steps do you believe the Iowa legislature should take when it comes to abortion? Young states, I am pro-life. I prefer to see the Iowa Supreme Court rule in favor of the bill we passed last year to limit abortions with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. Going forward, we must provide support for expecting and new mothers by removing barriers that prevent children from growing up in a loving home with the support they need, such as lowering the cost of adoption. Brubaker's response to the same question, placing mothers who miscarry under criminal investigation is not pro-life. Practice of medicine without a license is already illegal. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrds and Governor Kim Reynolds' Iowa Code 23.2 embezzlement to off-campus UIHC chemical abortion clinics needs to stop. We need to raise Iowa's birth rate while keeping the abortion rate as low as possible, and there is no silver bullet. State funding for a first child should be considered. We need more having a first child in their early 20s when they are young and healthy. And Snyder's response, the government should not interfere with health care. Pregnancy is a health condition that should be reserved for families and their doctors. The government should not insert itself in medical decisions.
And turning to national and world news, Trump's defense team gets its turn at Cohen. After a day and a half of ex-lawyer Michael Cohen telling his story his way, former President Donald Trump's attorney pounced on the prosecution's star witness, interrogating his memory and motives. Prosecutors in the first criminal trial of a U.S. president are trying to prove that Trump falsified business records to cover up unlawfully interfering in the 2016 election through a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. Truck has pleaded not guilty. The prosecution portrayed Cohen as remorseful, a brass-knuckled worm who turned and regretted his loyalty to the boss. However, Cohen's record is spotty. He pleaded guilty to lying to Congress, among other crimes, and was disbarred. As the witness spoke, defense lawyers sharpened their knives. Under aggressive questioning by attorney Todd Blanche, Cohen acknowledged calling the former president a dictator douchebag on TikTok and saying that Trump belongs in a cage like an animal. He admitted he had persisted in commenting on the case even after prosecutors expressed frustration. The jurors appeared riveted. Cohen said he was on TikTok, where he mentions Trump practically daily to quote-unquote vent. But yes, he answered Blanche, he was also there to make money. The defense showed pictures of Trump-themed merchandise Cohen sells, including mugs reading, "Send him to the big house, not the White House." "I would like to see accountability. It's not for me, it's for the jury and this court," Cohen said in response. Though the defense generally wants to show Cohen was a liar, Blanche said, asked him to confirm he hadn't lied when he praised Trump in 2016. "I was knee-deep in the cult of Donald Trump, yes," Cohen said. Though the presumptive GOP presidential nominee has lost the good opinion of his former fixer, he had plenty of support in the courtroom from his son, Eric, Eric's wife, Lana Trump, co-chair of the Republican National Committee, and rival-turned-vice presidential hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy. And he had support outside, where House Speaker Mike Johnson spoke in a park, saying Trump can't, under a gag order that prohibits him from criticizing witnesses, jurors, court staff, or the judges' families. An appeals court upheld the gag order Tuesday. Quote, "The judicial system in our country has been weaponized against President Trump," the Louisiana Republican said. Cross-examination will continue Thursday. Earlier in the day, Cohen cut to the core of the prosecution's case. Why did he pay Daniels $130,000? Quote, "To ensure that the story would not come out, would not affect Mr. Trump's chances of becoming president of the United States," Cohen said. Would Cohen have paid, if not for the campaign? No. On whose behalf did he do it? Mr. Trump. Cohen said he submitted invoices that falsely stated they were for a retainer agreement or services rendered in 2017. He had already told jurors these payments were in fact reimbursing him for the Daniels payment, as well as reimbursing him for another expense and padding his 2016 bonus. Prosecutor Susan Hoffinger displayed a series of checks for those payments. Several had Trump's personal signature, Cohen said, confirming earlier witnesses. He admitted he wanted to cash in as the president's personal lawyer, saying he made $4 million from clients around that time. Anticipating the defense, Hoffinger addressed a lapse in honesty directly. A February 8, 2018 statement Cohen's lawyer made to the Federal Election Commission. The statement referred to, quote, "Ms. Clifford," end quote, Daniels' legal last name. It said, "Neither the Trump Organization nor the Trump campaign was a party to the transaction with Ms. Clifford, and neither reimbursed Mr. Cohen for the payment directly or indirectly." The sentence was literally true, but intentionally misleading, Cohen said. Trump's revocable trust, and Trump himself reimbursed him. Cohen later pleaded guilty to campaign finance violations, including in relation to the Daniels hush money. Judge Juan Marchand told jurors that they could not consider the Federal Election Commission's investigation when determining Trump's guilt. In 2018, the FBI raided Cohen's office and the tables began to turn. Cohen called Trump. "I was scared," he testified. "I wanted some reassurance that Mr. Trump had my back, especially as this dealt with issues that related to him." Trump called back and said, allegedly, "Don't worry, I'm the President of the United States. There's nothing here. Everything's going to be okay. Stay tough. You're going to be okay." End quote. "I felt reassured because I had the President of the United States protecting me. His Justice Department should go nowhere," Cohen said. "And I remained in the camp, lying about Trump's involvement." Trump conveyed a message via tweet as well, as was his wont. The president praised Cohen as, quote, a fine person with a wonderful family, end quote, and said while most people would flip, Trump didn't see Cohen doing that. Those tweets reinforced my loyalty, Cohen said. But he eventually decided his loyalty should be to my wife, my daughter, my son, and the country, he said. Trump's call from the White House was, Cohen testified, the last time they spoke. The prosecutor asked Cohen if he had any regrets about his time with Donald. Yes, the disgraced lawyer said. I regret doing things for him that I should not have, Cohen said. To keep the loyalty and to do things that he had asked me to do, I violated my moral compass and I suffer the penalty, as has my family. Hoffinger said she had no further questions.
More national news. GOP steps up pressure over RNC protest area. Republicans are stepping up lobbying for the U.S. Secret Service to buffer the Republican National Convention facilities from a designated protest area. In a letter to Secret Service, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky echoed concerns raised earlier by a lawyer for the Republican National Committee. Quote, I am deeply concerned about reports that the security perimeter around the Republican convention site in Milwaukee may be creating a likely and preventable area of conflict between protesters and convention attendees and delegates, he wrote in a Friday letter to Kimberly A. Cheadle, director of the U.S. Secret Service. The RNC will take place in Milwaukee from July 15th through the 18th, bringing tens of thousands of visitors to the swing state's biggest city. Last month, GOP officials urged the Secret Service to move protests farther down the downtown venues that will host the RNC than the expected site at Pierre Marquette Park on the west side of the Milwaukee River. In a letter, an attorney for the Republican National Committee argued that holding protests there would mean convention attendees would have to walk right by the park on State Street or Kilbourne Avenue to reach the venues, creating a mandated confrontational area. Meanwhile, protest organizers have sought a closer location. McConnell, in his letter, cited the potentially volatile nature of a political convention and a challenging year for protest in the U.S. Quote, while I am a strong proponent of the First Amendment rights to assemble and speak, time, place, and manner restrictions exist for a reason, he wrote. In a potentially volatile situation, like a major political convention located downtown in a large city, it's imperative that we balance the place of those First Amendment activities with the safety and activities conventions, the safety of the attendees, and particularly preserving clear access points for the convention. The Washington Post first reported the letter. In a statement, Secret Service Chief of Communications Anthony Guglielmi said security plans for events like the RNC are developed by members of a federal, state, and local agencies who have the greatest understanding of the host city and the expected security environment for the event. The development of a security plan is based on security considerations, including risk and threat assessments, and is not a political matter. City officials have said the city must provide a speaker's podium and march route that is within sight and sound of the RNC under the Constitution and the RNC Framework Agreement to which city leaders signed on in 2022.